Welcome to State of the News. I'm Rick Howlett. Well, basketball is, of course, on the minds of many on this day before the Final Four and the much-anticipated showdown between the Cards and the Cats. We're, of course, going to talk about it later in the program, but we begin, as always, with our WFPL News Roundtable and a look at the week's developments in and around Louisville Metro. Philip M. Bailey, Erica Peterson, and Devin Katayama are here. Welcome all.
Hey, Rick.
Hey, Rick.
Nobody's wearing the UK or U of L colors today, except Devin.
And it's plaid, so it's plaid. It's kind of a mix.
And it's an orange plaid.
It's an orange plaid,
for
listeners.
So I'm wearing green. We're all neutral today, as a good journalist should be. Well, we welcome your input in today's program, 502-814-TALK, 502-814-8255. Toll free, 1-877-TALK. That's 1-877-814-8255. You can email us at news@wfpl.org, send us a tweet at WFPLnews, or reach us through Facebook. Well, Devin, let's start with you and some possible developments with the Louisville Orchestra. This impasse between the musicians and management has been going on for quite a while now, but there's some movement this week.
Yeah, the musicians sent a kind of what's being called a proposal, and this is in response to the Louisville Orchestra management asking that they come to an agreement for arbitration by Monday. What they propose, though, is being called vague by Louisville Orchestra CEO Robert Berman. Within the letter that they sent over to Louisville Orchestra, it's not very clear how many musicians the letter represents, whether it's going to be within the contract that management initially wanted. And that being the case, it's very unclear to management whether the proposal that the musicians put out is going to be within the budget of orchestra management.
So under this proposal, they would go back to work for what, a year under the current terms?
Yeah, a year under the current terms. It's about $900 a week. And then they would enter into that binding arbitration that they've been trying to, or management has been trying to get the musicians into. Under that contract, it would still include a review of the overall management, a review of the whole Louisville Orchestra itself. But then they would ultimately be, the future of the Louisville Orchestra musicians would be in the hands of the arbitrator.
And over this one-year period, that would be a 55-piece orchestra, right?
Yeah, at this point, it's 55-piece. Mm-hmm. Robert Berman today said, I got the feeling like it was very flexible. He didn't really say for sure 55, and that number has been flexible itself, 55, 60, 60 to 50 sometimes. So it's very unclear. Robert Berman said it's not to think that this is a huge step in a direction of reaching an agreement, mm-hmm. but it is a step.
There is at least some movement going on.
At least some movement. They're meeting today, actually right about now, they're meeting Louisville Orchestra Management's meeting to discuss this latest proposal to see if it even is a response to the what they were hoping that they'd have by Monday.
All right, Devin, we'll remain on top of that story. Let's turn to Philip M. Bailey and Devin. Both of you have been covering this. There's been, of course, the ripple effect from the Trayvon Martin shooting. Florida teen shot to death in Florida by a neighborhood block watch captain. Some local demonstrations this week, and Philip, another one set for, what, Monday?
Yeah, you've seen, I think, over the past week, the sort of the national movement to address the Trayvon Martin shooting come here to Louisville. Obviously, earlier this week, there was a demonstration out at the University of Louisville. There was one in front of the federal courthouse. I believe there was also one scheduled for Waterfront Park. I'm not sure if that one went on or not. And you will see, I think, a few more of these, particularly as the conversation begins to get more and more heated now that George Zimmerman, the man who's accused of murdering Trayvon Martin, or at least supporters of Trayvon Martin want him arrested and accused of that, supporters of his begin to speak out publicly as well. And certainly the tint of this story has a lot of elements that are combustible, not only the issue of race, but the issue of the Stand Your Ground law and the Second Amendment rights that were passed down there in Florida. So those elements are beginning to come more and more tinted across the country, particularly in a state, in a city like here in Louisville, Kentucky, where you had Senator Mitch McConnell, he was asked about the situation not too long ago. He dodged the question of whether this should have a conversation about the Florida Stand Your Ground law, but certainly this is becoming an issue that has many tentacles, not just the shooting itself.
And Devin, you attended one of the rallies this week.
Yeah, right? Well, University of Louisville held a rally, and that was actually earlier in the week. Since then, we've actually been hearing a lot of coverage from NPR, also newspapers around the country, and more information continues to come out. But what you continue to see in all the papers is this idea of solidarity, and it doesn't have to do necessarily with race as far as the people who are supporting the cause. Different people are coming out, and that's what you saw at U of L. I talked to President James Ramsey, and he wasn't aware that the rally was scheduled for Monday, or at least he said he wasn't, but he said that he does respect the First Amendment rights of the students. And I kind of felt like that was to say, like, because it was a walkout slash rally, that he was at least supporting the students' right to free speech.
All right, Erica Peterson, let's turn to you, WFPL Environment Reporter. You reported this week that the EPA is proposing some rules that would limit carbon pollution for all future power plants. What does this mean?
Well, this is basically the first time that the EPA has regulated carbon dioxide emissions. And they can do that because a couple of years ago, it went to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court ruled that they could, in fact, regulate greenhouse gases under the Clean Air Act if they could prove that they were hazardous to human health. And they came out with that ruling in 2009. So as far as the law goes right now, they can regulate this. And the rule that they're proposing, and this is not final, there's going to be public comment and things like that on it, basically puts a limit on carbon dioxide from power plants, all future power plants that aren't existing right now. And there's a grandfather clause for power plants that are permitted. As long as they break ground within this year, they won't be subject to these regulations.
So what kind of reaction have you been hearing to the rule?
The reaction has been pretty predictable. Environmental groups are excited about it, and coal groups are not. And I should say that the real significance of this rule is the limits it places on carbon dioxide are such that a gas power plant that's built in the future, assuming that it's built with the available technologies right now, could still operate under these rules. But for a coal power plant to be built, it would have to employ some kind of carbon capture and sequestration, which obviously is still slightly unproven and adds a lot to the cost of a power plant. So the coal industry is kind of eyeing this nervously, because if this becomes final, it means that the ability of companies to burn coal in new power plants in the U.S. is going to be greatly diminished.
Now, would this have any kind of local impact here in Louisville?
Not right now. LG&E, as you know, has plans to retire the Cane Run power plant and build a natural gas power plant. And that they said this rule won't affect that natural gas power plant. It should be able to operate just fine under the new constraints. And they don't have any plans right now to build any new coal power plants. And I would expect if this rule becomes finalized, that will kind of put the kibosh on any inkling that they would.
All right. Thanks, Erica. Philip, let's go back to you. We heard this week from Louisville's new police chief, Steve Conrad, who told the Metro Council's Public Safety Committee that, of course, his goal to make Louisville the safest city in America. But there's the challenge of budget constraints. Then he's calling on residents to take some action as well.
Yeah, Chief Conrad testified before the Public Safety Committee this week. He also had spoke at the Rotary Club earlier that day as well. And you sort of heard him echo the same thing at both meetings, saying that while he wants to make Louisville the safest city in America, a line you've often heard probably and will hear throughout his tenure more than likely, he also reiterated the fact that given the recession and how that's sort of put certain constraints on police departments and certain crimes they can focus on, the citizens will have to do more in their part in making sure that Louisville's a safer city. This conversation really focused more on the question when Councilman Jerry Miller brought up the issue of blight and crime surrounding vacant properties, which is a growing problem in the city. This goes back to the broken windows philosophy that has been in academia for a number of decades. Certainly people remember that Councilman David Tandy during his mayoral campaign talked about broken windows as a philosophy, meaning that if law enforcement pays attention to sort of these lower crimes, misdemeanors like vandalism, graffiti, etc., that will somehow stop higher and more violent crimes. So, and Chief Conrad basically said that when it comes to crimes such as that, he expects that citizens will have to do more, that they can't rely solely on Metro government to take up that responsibility, that they should have a certain chief investment in how the neighborhood looks, and they can help officers in that way. But that if they do their part, police will do theirs, and they can somehow meet halfway on some of those smaller crimes such as blight and things of that nature.
Of course, we've been reporting that Mayor Fisher's been looking for ways to cut millions of dollars in shortfalls from the current budget and the next budget. Does it look like the police department is going to take a hit in this?
You don't see any overall cuts. I know that the mayor did in this budget propose delaying one recruit class from March until June, which will save, I believe, about $600,000, a little over $600,000 in the budget. So you don't see any major cuts to the department. You saw some of those during the tenure of Mayor Abramson, where you saw certain civilian positions not being filled, but not as far as officers on the street or equipment. You haven't heard any real complaints in that situation. However, currently the FOP and the city are in current negotiations, ongoing negotiations for their union contract. So you may begin to hear some complaints from the union on that aspect. But haven't been really any major cuts that council members or any other critics have pointed out recently.
All right. Thanks, Philip. Devin, speaking of budgets, you've been reporting on the budget situation across the Ohio River in Jeffersonville. Department heads there are going to have a meeting on how to save some $3.5 million in the budget.
Yeah, the budget that they proposed last year was about $3.5 million more, or they expected $3.5 million more in property tax. And this goes back to the 2009 property tax cap that Indiana put in place to, give residents a little more support in the down economy. But what it essentially does, it places a tax cap for both property owners, renters, and commercial property, both at 1%, 2%, and 3%, respectively, percent of their assessed value of the house. But what this means for local governments is they basically propose what they think they're going to be getting in property taxes. The Department of Local Finance tells them what they actually get later on. So they are $3.5 million short. What that means is that they're going to have to be reworking their 2012 budget, which they'll be doing in the upcoming months. They're actually meeting next week to talk about cuts that are likely to happen. And I talked to City Attorney Les Merkley, who said that every department is going to be looked at. Now, several departments have already had to make cuts, and I know the fire department has kind of been trying to get actually more people on staff to actually save in overtime pay, and the education department has had to make huge cuts as well. So it'll be interesting to see which departments actually come through with the needed cuts, but Les Merkley does say that everyone's on board. The council's on board. The departments are they knew that they saw this coming down the road. Every year since 2009, they've had these sort of shortfalls, so this is nothing new for them.
And I guess at this point, of course, they haven't had the meeting yet, but it looks like that everything is on the table in terms of possible cuts.
Yeah, it's going to be a meeting with all the department heads. Mayor Mike Moore is going to sit down with them. They already know the situation. They know where the cuts are likely to come from. They haven't come out right and said it, but they have been preparing for this specific type of thing to happen.
All right, Erica, let's go back to you. It seems like we have an upper big branch of mine story every week because of this thing is. The fallout continues to occur, but there was a big news out of West Virginia about the investigation into that tragic explosion in 2010 at the Upper Big Branch Mine. So what happened this week?
Well, this week, the superintendent, Gary May, former superintendent of the mine, he was charged last month in the explosion, and he pled guilty yesterday to the charges. So he's pleading guilty to felony conspiracy charges.
And what kind of a sentence is he facing?
Well, he's going to be sentenced in August, and he could get up to 5 years and a $250,000 fine.
Are there any signs as to whether prosecutors will be looking higher up in the company leadership?
Well, it's not clear, and that's what everyone is really pushing for. Kind of typically in these mine investigations, in these explosion investigations, the upper echelons of the mine company have always been kind of insulated. They've never been able to successfully prosecute, you know, the top guy, who in this case would be Don Blankenship, the former CEO of Massey Energy. But they have not ruled it out, and the prosecutor, U.S. Attorney Booth Goodwin, in this case, has made it clear that he's willing to take it as high up as he needs to. And all they'll say about it at this point is that the investigation is still ongoing. So we might see some more charges out of there at some point.
Well, we have you here. Let's talk about MSD for a moment, because you also reported that back here in Louisville, the Metropolitan Sewer District is widening its ethics policy to apply to all employees. What's in this new policy?
Yeah, switching gears a little bit. So obviously, after the audit that came out in December, MSD has been kind of taking a lot of new actions to address the concerns that were raised in that audit. And one of those was the ethics policy. Last month, they adopted a new ethics policy for kind of the board and also the executive level employees. And this one that they adopted this week just kind of widens that to all staff. And it's a, you know, it's pretty much a straightforward ethics policy. It sets down standards to avoid things like conflict of interest and nepotism. But one of the interesting things that they also did was they kind of defined their whistleblower rule a little bit more. And they also put in place a whistleblower hotline and website, which will be managed by a third party, and it'll basically allow any MSD employee who wants to blow the whistle on any kind of wrongdoing to either call or email, and gives them the option to remain anonymous. So the ethics policy also kind of reminded employees that they're still covered by this whistleblower policy.
All right. Thanks, Erica. Philip, let's go back to you and back to the Louisville Metro Council, because you covered another committee meeting this week, budget committee. And they have reluctantly agreed to approve $10.8 million payment to Kentucky Retirement Systems. What's that about?
Council members were not happy with this decision. Basically, what this means is that the city will repay KRS, Kentucky Retirement Systems. This all stems from the firefighter settlement from really going all the way back to 1985, where firefighters sued for back pay, saying they weren't paid proper overtime. KRS basically says that the city, because of that, did not put a proper amount of money into the county retirement employee system over the years. Some city officials, including Vice Budget Chairman Kelly Downing, said that the city did do that after the settlement was made, basically saying that, you know, we shouldn't have to pay this. But after meeting with the county attorney's office and others, Councilman Downing and other council members who were critical and didn't want to vote for the approval of the payment and thought it was much less, relented and agreed that that was the amount, the $10.8 million should be paid. The only amendment that was introduced was that I believe $3.8 million will be paid in this fiscal year before the deadline on April 5th, and the rest of the $7 million will be paid July 1st after the fiscal year, or at the beginning of the new fiscal year. That all depends, however, on the board of KRS, I guess, allowing for that to happen. They could simply say, come back and say, no, the deadline is April 6th. You have to pay the full amount with interest. So there was a lot of complaint on the council about the fact that, you know, KRS isn't even paying out their own interest to employees through the pension system, and that they're passing that cost down to local government. But something that, you know, the council members, although they reluctantly did it, they feel it was necessary and it was better for the Louisville taxpayers to pay now and to pay later. However, Ann Oldfather, who represents some firefighters, said that because of there still is another settlement that's out there, the city could end up paying now and paying later with another interest for that's still out there that hasn't been yet forwarded by the state.
Now, the full council doesn't always rubber stamp what these committees do. A lot of times they'll just go back and rearrange everything. But does it look like this will be approved by the full council?
Well, there are some, I mean, because Councilman Miller and Councilman Downer were some of the lead critics on not paying this amount, it's expected that other critics who felt the same way, including Councilman Dan Johnson, who attended that committee meeting, I believe you'll see some discussion there, the same sort of regurgitation of that argument. But at the end of the day, it's expected that the council will approve this payment.
And finally, switching to, we're going to talk about the big basketball game with some other folks coming up later. But I do want to mention, when there's a big game like this, government leaders like to get involved. Mayor Fisher's all excited about the CDK U of L game. He wanted to have a pep rally, but U of L kind of said no.
It seems that every political leader wanted to sort of get a little bit of swag from the game. Mayor Fisher, however, when he proposed to do this pep rally, the U of L athletics department rejected, no pun intended, that proposal, basically saying no, the team has a serious game to focus on, Mr. Mayor, and that won't be happening. So instead, what the mayor did was the proclamation for the Cardinal Red Day, which is today, Friday, basically asking all residents to wear red, businesses display red in their doors and windows. The mayor came out today with an announcement proclaiming that the city has achieved a world record. There's no numbers to verify that.
All right.
But he's made the proclamation and he's made the declaration. He's also predicted that U of L will win the game, 62-58. That's a pretty low score if you ask most sports analysts. But, you know, the mayor's getting into it. Congressman Yarmuth and Congressman Chandler, they had their little joust on the steps of the Capitol in Washington. Obviously, Congressman Chandler representing parts of Lexington. The governor and lieutenant governor are heading down to New Orleans to watch the game. So are a couple of council members. So everyone's caught the fever pretty much at this point, whether they're cards or cats.
Somebody asked Rick Pitino about the pep rally, and he said, listen, we were in Portland. We went straight to Phoenix for all these games. Been gone for, you know, almost 2 weeks. Got to come home and get caught up on school and the laundry and all this kind of stuff.
Laundry, school. Yeah. And, you know, you don't want to have anything, you know, like accidentally, like the mayor tripping over a player's foot and breaking his ankle or anything
exactly.
Like that.
Let's play it safe and get the game played. All right. That's going to do it for our WFPL roundtable. Philip M. Bailey, Devin Katayama, Erica Peterson, thanks for joining us.
Thanks
Rick.
And enjoy
your
weekend. When we come back, we're going to talk to Kentucky Public Radio's Kenny Colston about the waning days of the Kentucky General Assembly. This is State of the News on WFPL. Welcome back to State of the News. I'm Rick Howlett. Well, Kentucky lawmakers are voting today on a state budget agreement hammered out by House and Senate leaders in the wee hours of the morning earlier this week, yesterday as a matter of fact. Kentucky Public Radio's Kenny Colston has been covering the budget talks and other developments at the State House and joins us now. Welcome back, Kenny.
Thanks for having me, Rick.
And that was early yesterday, wasn't it, when they reached that agreement?
It was 5 minutes to 3 a.m., according to Senator Williams.
Wow. So it looked like when we last talked a week ago, it was going to be fairly smooth sailing for the budget this year, and then suddenly there was talk about lawmakers going home without one, and even the possibility of the governor having to call a special session. What were the sticking points?
the sticking points were for the house. It was over school construction, and it wasn't even for the next 2 years. It was actually for planning for 2014 through 2016. The House argues that these are, you know, they've been doing this basically pretty regularly since 1985, putting in bonds for future projects. It allows for schools to look ahead and see, you know, plan for and design for, you know, expansions or renovations, you know, a few years ahead. And obviously the Senate's big proposal was bonded debt. They wanted less debt, less bonded debt, less structural imbalance. So that was a sticking point. The Senate eventually gave in. There were some other, you know, small things, you know, how to fund Rupp Arena expansion, you know, renovations, the horse park. Like I said, the Senate wanted less debt, less spending. And, you know, there's always a lot of posturing when you get to these budget, you know, to the end of a budget. And this year was no different. Except for last year, in past years, except for when the clock started really ticking, they actually came to the table and got something done.
So Governor Beshear proposed an austere budget at the beginning of the session, and that's pretty much what lawmakers are poised to approve today.
Well, actually, lawmakers trimmed it down even more. Yeah. So the governor said that he had an inadequate budget and to fund the needs of Kentuckians, and lawmakers put in even less money in. So I would hate to think what he would refer to this budget as. But basically, you know, it was a tight budget, and there's no way around that.
Is there any threat of a veto?
Well, I'm sure the governor will line item veto some items. He always does. But what's happening is of course, that conference committee compromise that we're talking about now, it has finally landed on lawmakers' desk. They are breaking and looking over the plan now before they vote on it, probably in a few hours. And with them voting on it today, it allows them to come back 2 weeks from now and override any of the governor's vetoes, if he vetoes anything. But I would think he always usually has one line or two, and since he can go one by one, he could, you know, cross out an A, dot a T, or, you know, cross a T, dot an I.
Right.
He can really do whatever. So they're preserving their veto power, and I'm sure that veto will be used, and the lawmakers will talk about overriding them.
So there's a vote today. We're talking live early afternoon. There's a vote today, and then lawmakers go home, and there's a veto period?
That's right. It's about a week and a half. They're planning to return on April 12th. Of course, the governor gets so many days to veto a bill or it becomes law. And so basically they give themselves plenty of time for the governor to veto bills today, you know, starting because tomorrow does not count. The clock does not officially start until Monday. So they give the governor plenty of time. Then they come back, look at what he's vetoed, and decide whether or not they're going to override it or not. Basically, it's a nice little week and a half break. Lawmakers will be back up here either the 12th or the 13th, and they'll look at the bills and say, either we don't care or, yeah, we want to override this.
Are there any other big issues still on the table at this late date?
Well, there actually are. You've got the prescription pill bill, which is House Bill 4. Actually, they had a conference committee, which is closed. They could not agree, so now they're in basically free conference committee, which that means they can throw anything in there at that point. But that's probably likely to go to the veto day. The road plan is still delayed. That's going to go to the veto day, or they won't have one at all, House Speaker said. That would be disastrous. You're talking about not having funding for the Louisville Bridges project, for widening I-65. That could be disastrous. But lawmakers are pretty confident they'll get to the veto day and have an agreement. So those are the two big issues. Other than that, you've got a lot of issues that are getting sent to the governor's desk. Lawmakers are agreeing or disagreeing, and you know the leaders have to sign bills for them to go to the governor's desk. So we're still looking at that pseudoephedrine issue. It has not been signed by legislative leaders, so technically it is not at the governor's desk yet. And then, of course, the dropout bill. That's been played out with a little bit, and that could pop out today or it could die on the last day.
Now, I'm still hearing commercials in support of calling your lawmaker in support of charter schools, but that's pretty much off the table for this session, right?
Yeah. Chairman Rollins, basically, the Senate amended one of House Education Chairman Carl Rollins' bill that dealt with districts of innovation, which is what he called charter-like program. They tacked charter schools on the end of that bill. That really upset the chairman, and he called that issue both of those issues, his and charter schools, dead. And there really hasn't been any movement in the House to talk about, you know, taking up his bill again. So I believe charter schools are probably done, but they've made enough progress that they'll probably have a strong argument next legislative session.
Speaking of next session, one of the big disappointments for Governor Beshear this session was, of course, the his casino gambling amendment failed. Do you think there's going to be any effort to revive it next time around?
You know, that's the chief initiative of the governor. So I have to think before he leaves office, we're going to continue to hear about and see this issue, what that issue looks like, whether it's, you know, statute or constitutional amendment. I don't really know. There's not a lot of talk about that right now. A lot of the focus is on the budget and the road plan. But I would have to think the governor will continue to try to find a way to get expanded gambling in Kentucky until he leaves office.
And I apologize if you mentioned this and I was distracted, but there was a tax amnesty bill was being considered. Is it still up for consideration?
Yeah, there's a compromise on that. Lawmakers are going to push that through probably today. Not a whole lot of changes, a reduction from what the governor wanted in terms of, I guess, scope and people who are going to work on it. But at the same time, that will get done.
Now, this was not complete. Is this complete amnesty, or is this something we just work out something with the state on paying back taxes?
Yeah, I think you have to pay a portion of your back taxes. And then once you agree to the amnesty, you have to pay your taxes, I think, for 3 to 5 years in a row. You can't be late again. Otherwise, they'll come back for the full thing. But it allows for people to only pay a portion of their taxes and get the rest forgiven. You really see people who haven't, like, paid their taxes, or corporations who haven't paid their taxes for 5, 8, 10 years. 10 years is the limit. But they're going kind of for the big dogs in this program.
They've had these in the past and collected a fair amount of money.
Yeah, and in this budget, they expect to collect $19 million, which isn't, I mean, in a $19 billion budget, yeah, doesn't seem like a lot of money, but $19 million is a pretty good chunk of change when you're talking about, I mean, it's not Mega Millions cash, but, you know, it'll help the budget a little bit.
That's right, every little bit helps. Well, Kenny Colston covers the Kentucky General Assembly and issues in Frankfort for Kentucky Public Radio, which includes WFPL. Kenny, thanks for joining us. Have a good weekend.
Thanks, you too.
You're listening to State of the News on WFPL. Well, the KFC Yum Center opened to great fanfare in October of 2010, and it has not been a disappointment by most, if not all, accounts. It's the home of the Louisville basketball program, men's and women's programs, but has also hosted major concerts. And last month, the South Regional of the Men's NCAA Basketball Tournament, among other events. Courier-Journal's Marcus Green has been reporting that the Yum is getting rave reviews, but has not met expectations set for profitability, and joining us to talk about it is Mr. Green. Marcus, welcome back.
Rick, thanks for having me.
Well, how much profit has the arena been showing, and how far below projections are the numbers running?
Well, basically, the expectation for this year, and the final numbers for 2011, which is the first full year, they're not out yet. They will be out, from what we've been told, here in April, when the the Louisville Arena Authority holds its monthly meeting. And the expectation is that it'll be around $500,000. That's clearly, anything in the black is very good for sports arenas, but the issue with profitability at the arena is troubling because it essentially forms the backstop of helping to make the debt payments. Whether the arena were profitable by a dollar or $500,000 or $2 million really wouldn't be an issue unless the monies that are going to the debt payments weren't adequate, and right now they're not adequate, and therefore this profitability issue has become an issue. Harold Workman, who's the head of the Fair Board, which operates the arena, told me last month that he expects that eventually, once all the everything is ironed out and they figure out the operations, they expect to get about $2 million a year. However, that is lower than the expectations, and so as a result, the Arena Authority has commissioned a study to look from top to bottom at all the operating issues at the arena and present a report that will make recommendations, and that's expected here in April.
Well, the arena gets money, of course, from a variety of sources. Is there any one particular area that's pulling everything down?
Yeah, the big issue is in what's called tax increment financing. It's a wonky way of describing a pretty common method of funding developments, in which essentially you set a baseline figure for how much tax revenue is produced in a certain area. In the case of the arena, it's a 6-square-mile area. It includes all of downtown, so it would include all these developments near the arena, the O'Shea's and the Impalazzeri's and Doc Crow's and all of those sorts of things. And as that tax revenue, which is predominantly based on property and sales tax, as it grows year over year, a small percentage goes back to the developer, in this case, the Arena Authority, to help pay off the debt. However, that's been lagging behind its expectations. And as a result, as you go down the list of things that are available to help help pay the debt, when you get down to the operating income, it's just not there at the level that it had been expected to be.
Now, there were some amenities or restaurants or attractions or whatever that never materialized in that area, right?
Yeah. I mean, one of the issues here is that back in 2008, when the bonds were sold, it was based off of some projections on what would help provide that revenue. There were things like a restaurant that would be open 24/7, it would be open every day, sports bars, things of that nature that would be open to the public and available all the time. And as the plan came together, those things they didn't eventually materialize. So as a result, the projections that were put together to sell the bonds didn't include, some of the things in those projections haven't materialized. So then naturally you have, I think, in the case of those things, $900,000 a year that just isn't there.
Now, the University of Louisville is the main tenant, the basketball programs, and of course the university collects some money from events there. And I understand at least one authority, Arena Authority member, wants to sort of restructure its agreement with the university.
Right. Todd Blue, who's a developer, businessman here locally, serves on the Arena Authority board. And back in the fall, he started asking the question of if U of L is doing so well because of its deal, perhaps that deal should be altered to allow some of those monies to be split more equitably. Thus far, that hasn't gone anywhere, but depending on how things happen in the next 6 months to a year, presumably those calls could increase. Maybe they won't, but Todd Blue has been very vocal in asking for that to at least be examined.
And you've talked to Jim Host, the former, he's not the chairman anymore, right?
Still is the chairman. He announced that he would resign, but he hasn't resigned yet.
Okay.
And the last I heard, he's still the chairman. He's still there. But I have talked to Jim about this. Mm-hmm. And his take is that the issue is not, it's not on the revenue side, it's really on the expense side. Mm-hmm. And that's why this report that's going to come out here in April is so important, because it will look at the issue that clearly the Arena Authority believes is the problem in not allowing those operating profits to materialize.
You know, they got this thing financed and built, as you well know. We've been to all the meetings right in the middle of a recession, which is rather unbelievable. I would think this is a difficult time for arenas around the country.
Yeah, and in fact, what's occurring with the Louisville arena, for instance, the agencies that rate the bonds have put this project on a watch because there's concern with the tax increment financing numbers not being where they were projected, that potentially the bonds issued to finance this project could be downgraded, and they're not alone in that. The Orlando Arena, the arena where the Orlando Magic play, has had the same problem. Both of those were financed around the same time, around the time of the financial crisis in 2008.
Let's talk about the Ohio River Bridges project for a moment. You've been reporting on, and you reported that, of course, they've been talking about tolls to pay for the bridges, and now that there's the possibility of the Sherman-Minton Bridge being replaced a couple of decades down the line, and some lawmakers or some government officials want tolls on it to help pay for the whole Ohio River Bridges project, right?
Yeah, this was an interesting story we reported in yesterday's paper. There's been a financial plan set forth and agreed upon to take care of the bridges project, at least Kentucky's side. Kentucky would be responsible for the downtown bridge and Spaghetti Junction and the roads on both sides of the river. Now, the Sherman-Minton Bridge is not to be tolled as part of that. However, buried in the depths of the financial plan is an assumption that in 20 years, in 2031, that bridge is going to be replaced. And when it's replaced, it'll be a toll bridge. And that's important because, presumably, according to the figures, until then, people will avoid using that bridge. They'll avoid using the toll bridges downtown, and instead they'll use the Sherman-Minton.
Right.
Instead, which will be free. But once that becomes a toll bridge, it'll essentially normalize traffic, and people who might have had an incentive to drive Sherman-Minton will instead choose the I-65 bridges.
And that has taken some people by surprise.
It has, because it was never mentioned in any of the meetings. It wasn't mentioned to lawmakers. It was an assumption, and as the Secretary of Transportation, Mike Hancock, described it to me, he acknowledged it was a major assumption. They didn't ask the consultant to provide a scenario in which, for whatever reason, the Sherman-Minton Bridge may not be tolled down the road. Mm-hmm. Or if that project were to be delayed, instead of starting in 2031, let's say it didn't start till 2041. What those numbers show, and the state agreed to provide those numbers after I asked for them and they didn't have them, but what those numbers show is that there would be a shortfall. There's not enough money from toll revenue to cover all of the expenses. And at the end of a long list of expenses, there would be a shortfall. Now, who would have to pick up that shortfall? It would basically come from the state. It could come from maintenance funds being moved over. It could come from some kind of special appropriation from the General Assembly, but there definitely would be a shortfall under the state's projections.
And just very quickly, otherwise, the Ohio River Bridges project running pretty much on schedule?
Yeah, I think the big thing to see, to wait for now is what the Kentucky General Assembly does in terms of financing. But they've held meetings with contractors, and both sides of the river, the states say they want to break ground later this year.
All right. Marcus Green with Courier Journal, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Time for another break. We'll be back with more in a moment. Talk about the big game, the Final Four matchup between UK and U of L tomorrow in New Orleans. This is State of the News on WFPL. Welcome back to State of the News. I'm Rick Howlett. Well, it's almost time to stop analyzing the UK-U of L Final Four matchup and the Cards and Cats rivalry and everything else and finally just play the game. But not quite yet. First of all, let's begin with a report on the buildup to what some are calling the biggest sporting event in the Commonwealth's history. This has the feel of a Kentucky Derby week, with the national media lens on Louisville and Lexington focused not on thoroughbreds, but on what makes this basketball rivalry so intense. Rick Pitino is in the unique position of having coached both teams, first 8 years at Kentucky and now 11 seasons in Louisville. This week he explained the fan demographics to an out-of-town questioner.
We're sort of limited to our city. They have as many fans in our city, and it ends up with a lot of bad marriages, a lot of mixed marriages that end up bad. You know, you have a Louisville woman with a Kentucky man, and it always ends bad.
Both programs have well-established traditions, but Louisville is relatively new as a national power, coming to prominence with two titles during the Denny Crum era. Fans say U of L deserves more respect than it often gets from the UK faithful. Kentucky won the first of its seven titles in 1948, and Wildcat basketball has become a religion in many corners of the Commonwealth. UK fans have high expectations, including regular victories over Louisville. Just ask third-year coach John Calipari.
And I love our fans. They're crazy. They watch the game tapes three times. I don't watch the game tapes three times. But that's coaching and playing at Kentucky.
Is everyone passionate about college basketball in this area? No question. But it seems like the ones that get through on the internet and or on our shows are the crazy ones.
Tony Vannetti is co-host of the Afternoon Underdogs program on WKRD Radio in Louisville. He and partner Dave Jennings have been fielding lots of calls from fans on both sides this week. They've generally been respectful and often humorous.
My daughter come in my house wearing a blue shirt with Kentucky on it, and I looked out and asked her, "What's that you got on?" She told me, "She said, that's a Kentucky shirt." I said, "Well, you can turn around and go on back outdoor." And she took and pulled the shirt up. She said, "See, I got on a red shirt, a Louisville shirt." She was just joking with me.
The UK U of L Final Four matchup has spurred more talk about the rivalry between coaches Calipari and Pitino, who exchanged barbs in the media early in the season. But both told ESPN Radio this week that's all been overblown and there's no personal animosity. Here's Calipari, then Pitino.
I've known him for a long time. He's known me for a long time. I really respect him and what he does. And everybody's made more of it than it is.
There really is nothing to it, to be honest with you. We've never had negative words with each other. We've never had a problem. So the media just likes to hop on it.
They play every year now, but this is the first NCAA tournament showdown between Kentucky and Louisville in nearly 30 years. U of L won their 1983 Mideast Region Final matchup. The following year, UK was the winner in a Sweet 16 game.
Welcome to the Joe B. and Denny Show on Sports Radio 790.
Those Cats and Cards teams were coached by Joe B. Hall and Denny Crum, who now have their own radio show on WKRD. Louisville was the favorite in that 83 game and won by 12 points in overtime. This time, the Cards are the underdogs, but Crum says that's not necessarily a bad place to be.
It's hard to say that even though one team is the favorite, that it's a lock going in. I mean, that's sometimes the kiss of death for you.
Joe Hall believes the Wildcats are on their way to a national title, but both programs will benefit from their time in the national spotlight.
There's not enough you can say about what this game means, not only to the fans and the coaches, but to the future of the programs, the recruiting. It's just a very, very big game.
The Cards and Cats will tip off shortly after 6 p.m. Eastern Time Saturday in New Orleans. Rick Howlett, WFPL News. All right, and here to talk about the game and the rivalry and the teams and all that stuff are Eric Crawford of the Courier-Journal, who joins us from New Orleans, and Bill Doolittle from Leo Weekly. And tomorrow should be a pretty good day to be a sports bar owner. And here to tell us about the game's impact on those local businesses is the Courier-Journal's Chris Ott. Welcome, everyone.
Thank you.
Hey.
Are you there? Are you there, Eric?
Yes, I am.
All right, I hear you. Well, set the scene for us down there, first of all. Fans, of course, starting to arrive. The teams are there. What's the atmosphere like?
Well, Louisville just has completed its open workout here in the Superdome, and they probably, you know, there's a good crowd. A little, I'm not very good in a venue this big. It's hard to judge how many fans, but they had several thousand here for their workout. Rick Pitino is incredibly loose at this point, maybe looser than we've ever seen him before a big game. Led the Cards cheer before the team started practicing, and Kentucky will be out here in a couple of hours, obviously, with their throngs of people. So it's starting to ramp up.
Yeah, Rick Pitino really seems to be enjoying this. I covered the press conference the other day. You heard at the beginning, and I've covering him for 10 or so years. I've never seen him in such a good mood.
Well, the operative words around the Louisville camp right now are house money.
Yeah.
They feel like that they have already exceeded expectations. They've already had a special season. It's going to be a special season if they don't win, and they're really embracing this notion that all they have to do is go out and play hard and have fun and do the best they can. And you know, they're believing right now, so it'll be interesting.
Bill Doolittle, UK and U of L played regular now since 83, I guess, but most of those have been regular season games. Now, UK won the latest back in December and was expected to be here by most accounts, but no one predicted this run by the Cards that began, I guess, 8 games ago in the Big East tournament.
Yeah, it's just ruined things for Kentucky.
Yeah.
I mean, their fans are on the way to the coronation ball, and who gave tickets to Louisville to come and be? I mean, where did they come from?
How dare they?
Yeah, you know, it's a terrible thing for Kentucky. I really feel sorry for them.
Yeah. I think there's as fun as all this is, you know, the national spotlight, Kentucky well represented in the Final Four. Some people are just not able to enjoy it.
No, they're not. And you know, maybe it's just history. I go back to the Dream Game, and I was in the last time Louisville played in the Superdome in New Orleans in 1982. So this doesn't have that life or death import to me because it's a long history, and I think it's a very interesting thing that the teams play, but hardly earth-shaking.
Right. Eric, both Pitino and Calipari said that this rivalry thing between them or any personal animosity is really overblown. Is that true, or is there really something there?
Well, I guess I'm one of those media guys that is propagating the notion that there is something there. It's not been a pleasant rivalry. These are not guys that hang out together, and you know, I just think it's only escalated since Calipari got to Kentucky. So it's heated. You can watch the way their teams played. The first time they met in Rupp Arena was a rough game. There was a fight as soon as the game broke out, almost, and there was an incident where Calipari was yelling at a Louisville player. So it's heated, and their attempts, I appreciate their attempts to paint it as cordial, but I don't think it is.
And I agree completely.
Yeah. And some of this goes back, I guess, to Calipari was at Memphis and Pitino was at U of L. They were in Conference USA. They had a lot of
East and, you know, with Temple and John Chaney. A lot of people, I think, I don't know, Eric has his own opinion about it, but I think that Pitino represents more of a traditional way, and Calipari's the new gunslinger, and he's just not popular.
Okay, well, we'll see how it plays out. They've been playing nice all this week, so.
Yeah, and they should. I mean, they got enough things. Just let just get the basketball game out there. Will be enough entertainment for all.
Chris Ott with the Courier-Journal. You've been writing about what the impact of this game is going to have here in Louisville, particularly on sports bars. And boy, the folks running these things have to be rather giddy.
Right. I mean, it's like the Super Bowl for them. I mean, you know, you can't have a better matchup if you're a sports bar or really any place with a TV and a good setup for people to watch the game.
Now, I guess some are allowing just people to come in, or are those taking reservations?
Yeah, the vast majority of places that we were able to reach for this story are first come, first serve. They say doing reservations is just too much of a headache, and really first come, first serve is the fairest way to do it. And when you think about it, if you have people showing up at 4 or 4:30 and ordering food and drinks in preparation for a 6:09 tip-off, well, you know, that's more business as well. There was one place that we found, the BBC in St. Matthews, that's actually taking a novel approach and charging $5 a head for a reservation for a game time table, which is pretty interesting. But for the most part, it's going to be open. And if you want to get in for the game, you're probably going to have to come pretty early.
You're going to have this mixture of intense rivalry and alcohol in some places,
and
enthusiasm for the game. I guess some of these places are hiring extra security,
just
in case.
Yes, definitely. A lot of more of the bars that we spoke to are beefing up on their security, certainly. And the vast majority of places also are not designating themselves as UK places or U of L places. Bar Zanzibar caused a real stir earlier this week when they initially said that this is going to be U of L only on Facebook, which they said was really to prevent fighting. And then they kind of walked back from that after a backlash and a lot of angry calls and emails, and apologized and said the whole thing had gotten blown out of proportion and that everybody is welcome. But I thought that just kind of illustrates the dynamic here.
Yeah, it's a crazy time here in Louisville. Let's get back to the game for a moment, Eric. We haven't talked much about the players. Let's Anthony Davis injured his knee earlier in the tournament. I guess that was in the Baylor game. Is he okay?
Well, he says he's 90%, and Calipari says he's okay. And honestly, with him at 90%, he's probably still the best player in the country. He's been great all season long. It's a mismatch, really, that nobody has been able to overcome this season, including Louisville. The first time they met, Kentucky's been the best team all year. They've played like the best team, not just the most talented team, but they play the best together. And, you know, Louisville's goal, I think, is going to be just to hang and be in the game with 4 minutes left and hope the pressure kind of becomes one of their teammates and see if they can finish it out.
No other injuries or any other events since they got down there to anyone's worried about?
No, not unless something happened on Bourbon Street last night. You know, Patino let the players out last night. They were out, until 11 o'clock. So it was a pretty relaxed atmosphere in Kentucky. I haven't seen too much of them, but no more health concerns for them.
Of course, the UK and U of L fans are out there on Bourbon Street. Everybody behaving themselves, as far as you can tell?
I can't really, you know, it's funny. We've seen more Ohio State fans at this point than we have Louisville Kentucky fans. I think that's going to change tonight, though.
Well, you mentioned House Money and Patino and U of L being the underdog. Is a possibility that he'll try something novel or something special, offense or defense or strategy just for this game, since really they have nothing to lose?
It's possible, but, you know, you're limited to what your team can do. I think the surprise, if there's likely to be one, might come in personnel. We might see him use a guy like Wayne Blackshear or Kevin Ware a lot more than he used them during the regular season. We may see him work a guy like Zach Price in. I think that's where the surprise might come from Patino. You might see him use just different personnel. I don't think there's any strategy or tactic. I think they're going to do with what they've been successful doing. I think it may be an ugly game. They'll slow it down. They'll turn it into kind of one of those fights where the fighters are always clenching and see if they can be close when the end comes.
Bill, let's go on and get predictions before we run out of time. What's your prediction and the score?
I think it's going to be a very tight and intense game. I think Kentucky's been the most consistent team in the country this year, and I think they'd probably find a way to pull it out, maybe by 5 points.
All right. What do you think, Bill?
Who do I think will win?
Yes, and by how much?
Ohio State.
You
I think
the
they're
thing?
Sitting in by far. Yeah. If you look at it as a sports thing, you know, they're sitting in the opposite bracket. If they beat Kansas, they can let Louisville and Kentucky worry about each other, and they have an easier game to the Final Four. Or the final game, and if I were riding in a plane, I would say, well, we got the nice draw right here. So, and I think they have really good players, and they just haven't been as good as their players are. But that's kind of who I like. And then the Louisville-Kentucky game, I don't know. I'm a more of a Louisville fan, so I'll take Louisville.
What do you think, Chris?
Well, I went to the University of Alabama, so this basketball thing is completely foreign to me, and I'm totally unqualified to make a prediction. All I can tell you is I've been happy to see them both win. It's been exciting locally, and I think it probably helps us sell more papers. So,
okay. Well, I love both programs, but I'm a UK graduate, class of 83, so I'm going to go with the Wildcats, 81-76.
I think that's probably a wise choice right there.
All right. Chris Ott, Bill Doolittle, Eric Crawford, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have for today's program. For more information about topics discussed on today's program, visit WFPL.org. State of the News is produced by the WFPL News staff. Our production team is led by Laura Ellis and Brad Yost. I'm Rick Howlett. Have a good weekend.